This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Some people play by the rules, but the real game changers break them. I'm Soraya, and on Rule Breakers, we're talking to the risk takers, the rebels, and the ones rewriting the playbook. Follow and listen to Rule Breakers with Soraya on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Rich Zeoli Show podcast is sponsored by Mike Venaria Jr. with Osperity Private Wealth.
Hi, I'm Mike Venaria Jr., wealth management specialist. Make your retirement dreams a reality by creating your retirement plan today. Call me at 856-252-0107.
It's Thursday, but it's Friday for me, kids. Sorry to tell you. I'm reinstating a long-held tradition on the show, which is taking off on Friday. No, I'm just kidding. I have to get some foot thing done tomorrow as part of this whole nonsense. And Mary Walter will be in tomorrow, so you'll be in good hands with Mary. And then I'll be back on Monday and then off next Friday. But that's only because I'm taping Jimmy Fallon's show in New York. Otherwise, I would be here. And then I'm off a week after that. But that's only because the kids are on spring break. Otherwise, I'd be here. All right, but let's enjoy the time we have together now, because we never know when this is all going to come to an end. It could come to an end tomorrow. This could be my last show. I could die. You could die. Who knows? Life is too short. That's all I know. Speaking of people dying, though, by the way, before I get back into the topic of the day, Tom Cruise reacted for the first time to Val Kilmer's death. He was speaking at this thing, and he just commented what a great actor and friend he was, and he had a moment of silence for him. And in looking back on their friendship and their career together, from being in Top Gun, a movie Matt DeSantis has never seen and never will, and then, of course, Top Gun Maverick, a movie where their scene together brought us all tears. So Tom Cruise, who follows Matt DeSantis on Twitter, yeah, they see that this is what I don't understand, DeSantis, because you have in your Twitter handle, your X bio, that Tom Cruise follows you, yet you've never seen Top Gun, which is arguably his most famous movie.
Well, that is true. I've never seen Top Gun, but I've seen a lot of other Tom Cruise movies, and I've enjoyed them all. And honestly, Top Gun Maverick, everyone seems to believe Top Gun Maverick, including yourself, is better than the original Top Gun.
Absolutely.
I love Top Gun Maverick. Mission Impossible, those are all really good.
Yeah, and there's a new one coming out.
Yeah, the last one was excellent, and I believe it's a continuation of the previous one.
Yeah. Well, he's amazing. 62 years old. The guy does all his own stunts too. I mean,
Which is wild.
Always getting hurt, but he's
Didn't he fly all the jets in Top Gun Maverick as well?
Yeah, he did. He's crazy. He does it all himself. He doesn't want any stuntmen. So he's putting stuntmen out of work.
He's my dear friend.
Yeah. Speaking of actors, did you get me a dwarf? Nope.
No. Still nothing.
Okay.
Still working on it.
Amazing. All right, fine. Tom Cruise paid tribute to Val Kilmer Thursday while presenting at CinemaCon. He took the stage in Las Vegas, Nevada to reveal new footage from his upcoming film, Mission Impossible, The Final Reckoning. Prior to the debut, Cruise took a moment to honor his Top Gun co-star, who died on Tuesday of pneumonia. And he said, "I'd like to honor a dear friend of mine, Val Kilmer, for a moment. I can't tell you how much I admired his work." Cruise said he was grateful to work with Kilmer once again in the 2022 film Top Gun Maverick before asking for a moment of silence. "If we would all just take a moment to remember the wonderful time we had with him, let's just take a moment," he said, before closing with, "I wish you well on your next journey." Kilmer, who starred in many high-profile films, of course, died Tuesday in Los Angeles. He and Tom Cruise, and they reunited for Maverick after 30 years after the original. "They acted like they had never left each other's sides. It was like no time had passed at all," Kilmer had said. "We blew a lot of takes laughing so much. It was really fun, really special." Although he could portray his character, he still had difficulty due to damage from a the thing they do with the throat. It's not a trachea. I can't say it. T-R-A-C-H-E-O-S-T-O-M-Y. How do you say that? Tracheostomy? That's it, right? Tracheostomy.
Right.
That sounds about right. Tracheostomy. A tracheostomy, yeah?
I think that's probably not right.
Probably not accurate. Kilmer had to use a breathing tube after his trachea after his tagliatelle. And I think that's what the procedure is known as. In Italy, it's known as a tagliatelle. And here in America, they call it a tracheostomy. I think tagliatelle is better, personally. Tagliatelle or pappardelle? I can't speak without plugging the hole in the throat. You have to make the choice to breathe or eat, he told People magazine in 2021. So it was a lot for him to do that, and he apparently was bedridden for the last several years of his life. So very sad, but I was glad that Tom Cruise led that moment of silence, and very, very glad that that occurred. Okay, so tariffs. Now, by the way, weigh in. Feel free. 855-839-1210 on X at Rich Zeoli. All I can do is give you what my gut tells me, okay? I'm not wildly cheering this on. And I'm not spelling doom and gloom because I really honestly believe this is going to be a very short term thing that's going to result in countries lowering their barriers to entry on the United States of America, which I think is going to be a good thing. However, it's impossible to recreate the kind of tariffs we once had in this country when I don't know why we're bringing up Alexander Hamilton. That's the first thing I don't understand. It was a very different place from when Alexander Hamilton used tariffs and when the government used tariffs. So I think I'm just trying to do a little dose of reality here too, because there's some people who believe that these tariffs are going to be so successful without any economic harm whatsoever, it's going to be the end of income taxes. I think that's just not going to happen. And I think that this whole notion that this is going to be, you know, smooth Hawley all over again and lead to an economic catastrophe on a global scale, I think is also not going to happen. I think it's not even somewhere in the middle. I think it's going to be a short-lived thing where countries are scrambling to figure out what they need to do to lower their barriers to entry and what investments they can make in the United States of America. It's going to make him happy, and he's going to start announcing all these wins next week, and the market's going to react favorably, and then that's what's going to happen. That's what I believe. Look, maybe I'm wrong here, but I just don't think I am. Given my track record on predicting these things, I don't think I'm wrong. I don't think that these are in place for a long time. I know Trump is a tariff guy, but I think he also understands the economic reality of the world that we live in. And I think his motivation here is to end whatever barriers are imposed upon American companies doing business in other countries. That is his goal. And he wants to bring more investment into the United States. And if that means then he can get some European manufacturers to announce big investments to build plants here. And if that means that he can have Europe lower whatever entry tariffs and barriers they place on American automobiles, environmental barriers. I mean, remember, it's not just tariffs, too. A lot of these countries have other barriers to entry, including environmental. They have quotas on things. We do, too, in the United States. We have quotas on things. We have barriers to entry as well. But a lot of these countries around the world have barriers to entry that make the American, for example, agriculture. It's very hard for us to export agriculture to certain countries around the world. It's also hard for us to export automobiles around the world because of different environmental standards. And with tariffs, the companies just decide they're going to go invest and build plants in Europe. Well, then, I mean, it's a good thing for the company. It's a good thing for the company and your 401k, because your 401k is investing in that company. So I'm not diminishing that point. But from the American workers' perspective, what they'd like to see is they'd like to see then the reciprocity of a European company coming here and establishing a plant here and giving them jobs. Since Ford has given jobs to Germans at their plant, what they'd also like to see is other countries that have a barrier to entry that makes it so that they don't even either they have a plant there or export their cars there. Those barriers to entry go away. And then American cars that are built in the United States of America can be loaded onto a ship, brought to those countries and sold at a fair price. That's what the American automobile worker would like to see. So, yeah, I'm not you shouldn't take anything away from Ford for opening up plants in Europe. It makes sense for them to do so. And as a successful company, You want these companies competing in countries around the globe. That makes them more successful, and then that benefits all of us. It benefits your retirement. It benefits your 401k, your stock market, all of it. Absolutely, we do. And we want these countries competing in the global marketplace. So they don't want there to be a trade war either. And they don't want there to be a trade war. American companies don't want to have to deal with a trade war. European countries don't want to deal with a trade war. Asian companies don't want. Nobody wants a trade war. So whatever has to be done to reduce barriers to entry is what needs to happen here. I completely disagree with the Commerce Secretary or the Secretary of the Treasury, Scott Bessent, for bringing up Alexander Hamilton. Look, I tell you what I think. I tell you what I see, what my gut tells me. But I think Bessent's out of his freaking mind if he thinks that we're going to use tariffs the way Alexander Hamilton used them. I mean, I just think that that's insane. Like, I don't know, maybe he's referencing him because he just saw the play. I don't know. But, I mean, that part of it is ridiculous. Ridiculous. But this is what he said, cut number six.
Go back all the way to Alexander Hamilton. Alexander Hamilton used them to raise revenue. He used them to protect industry. And President Trump has added the third leg of the stool, which is strategic. So, you know, if we are thinking about a 10% global tariff, and let's assume that we import about $3 trillion a year, so that's $300 billion, and that's a substantial revenue raiser that could then be used for working Americans on no tax on tips, no tax on Social Security, no tax on overtime, and for those buying autos, they can reduce their bills because interest on American-made cars will be tax-deductible. So this is really a working class, the tariff and tax plan.
Okay. So there you go. The Alexander Hamilton equation is it's nonsense, but so is the idea that this is going to lead to global economic peril and doom and gloom. It's going to lead to countries opening up barriers of entry and ending barriers to entry to American goods. And that's what's going to happen. I'm telling you right now, it's what's going to happen. Maybe I'm wrong, but that's what's going to happen. But that means, though, that if you are hoping that tariffs are going to become the revenue source to drive America, and that means that we're going to get rid of taxes, I'm sorry to disappoint you. I don't see that happening. And, you know, you can get mad at me for that, but I just, you know, and maybe I'm wrong, but I don't see that happening either. So I think the reality is that this is just not going to be around long enough to be able to achieve that, nor do I think with this global marketplace it's realistic. So that's what I think. What do you think? 855-839-1210 on X at Rich Zeoli if you'd like to weigh in on all the things we are discussing today. And feel free to weigh in. Now, J.D. Vance, the vice president, who's probably going to be the Republican front runner in 2028, because I don't see Donald Trump actually really running for a third term. I think he's just, you know, messing with the minds of the media. This is what he said regarding all this, cut number two.
Explain to us how you get manufacturing here, but also get the cost down for the American people.
Well, if you go back a little bit, Lawrence, remember during the first Trump administration, everybody said that Trump's tariffs were going to be inflationary back then. What actually happened? We had 1.5% inflation. We had the fastest growing economy in a generation. And we had the beginning of a manufacturing renaissance in the United States of America. Then, of course, we had four terrible years of the Biden administration. But I think it's useful for all of us to step back and ask ourselves, what has the globalist economy gotten the United States of America? And the answer is fundamentally it's based on two principles: incurring a huge amount of debt to buy things that other countries make for us. And to make it a little bit more crystal clear, we borrow money from Chinese peasants to buy the things those Chinese peasants manufacture. That is not a recipe for economic prosperity. It's not a recipe for low prices, and it's not a recipe for good jobs in the United States of America. For 40 years, we have gone down that pathway. We've seen closing factories. We've seen rising inflation. We've seen the cost of housing so high that most Americans can't afford to buy a home right now. President Trump is taking this economy in a different direction. He ran on that, he promised it, and now he's delivering. And yes, this is a big change. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to shy away from it, but we needed a big change, Lawrence. Mm-hmm. We cannot keep going down the Joe Biden globalist pathway where we have $2 trillion of peacetime debt and deficits. We have manufacturing disappearing. That is not working for Americans. We've got to take this country in a different direction.
Susie loves Jeffy. It's her birthday today. I'm seeing on the YouTube chat. Happy birthday, Susie loves Jeffy. Happy birthday. Have a wonderful day. Let's sing. Ready? Just kidding. I'm not going to do that to you. All right. I'm not going to do that. That would be wrong. That would be wrong. But I will play you this song for your birthday. This is just for you, Susie loves Jeffy. And if you don't like it, you can thank Mike Lee. This is cut number 28 now. The video needs some description. Matt, would you like to provide that description for us?
I don't really even know how to describe it. You listen to it and maybe describe what we're witnessing. It's terrible. It's truly terrible. I wish you had never sent this to me.
Well, you can blame Senator Mike Lee, but for Susie Loves Jeffy's birthday, let's enjoy this. It's a bunch of people, men and women. They're wearing, some are wearing vests, and some are wearing what looks like pullovers and hoodies. I don't really know. Anyway, take a listen. And they're pointing to their nether regions.
Stop,
they're pointing to their nether regions. Okay? So, Justin, any, you want to describe that? You want to take a shot at that?
I ain't got nothing, boss.
You got nothing? Yeah.
The video was originally posted to TikTok, and I think that this is a pretty solid argument as to why maybe that app should be banned after all.
So Amazon may buy TikTok, I saw.
Yeah, I'll believe that when I see it. Who knows what's going to happen? I think Saturday is the next deadline. But there's this guy
on Fox News yesterday who's saying that his company wants to buy it, and they want to do a revenue sharing plan with people who upload videos there and things like that. So I forget his name. I should have wrote it down, but I was making pancakes or something when he was on.
Was it the OnlyFans founder, Tim Stokely? I know he's made a pitch to buy.
But that would make sense because OnlyFans has done a great service to teachers and stay-at-home moms everywhere who've become multimillionaires overnight by simply showing pictures of their feet. I tried to get in on that market too, but you know.
Yuck.
Foot surgery. So, you know, my foot model days are over. But, man, if I could go back in time. Those stories annoy me, too. You read about this woman. She was making, you know, 40 grand a year. Starts going to OnlyFans. And she made $44 million last month. Like, how many freaking people are out there subscribing to OnlyFans sites? Because it's not like you pay one subscription and you have access to the whole site. You have to like find the model, and you pay to follow them, and then you pay extra money for their content. So that's crazy.
Yeah, it's wild. I have a theory. I don't know anyone that subscribes to OnlyFans.
Well, nobody's ever going to admit that. It's like reading Playboy for the articles. Nobody's ever going to tell you that they subscribe to OnlyFans.
I know a lot of shameless people that I think would be forthcoming with this information. My theory is that there is a small group of weird perverts that are subscribing to some of these OnlyFans pages, but they're dumping in far more than what the monthly rate is. They're probably shelling out a whole bunch of money for weird little extras. So you might have somebody who earns, $40,000 a month or whatever you figure you just said. But I bet it's based off of like 10 weirdos that are just sending $4,000 a month to the lady. I don't think it's as the popularity is as widespread as.
Well, you know what's going to happen one day? There'll be a data leak, just like there was with Ashley Madison many years ago. That was the affair site. And then all these emails are going to get published, and people are going to be like, oh, I only signed up because I was curious what it was. I didn't know. All right, I think our guest might be ready. I saw her pop up on the Zoom. So should I take a quick break and we'll come back?
Yeah, let's take a quick break and we'll come back.
All right, we'll come back. We'll do that. Big story of the hour, though, brought to you by our buddy, Dr. Mike Veneria. You got to go see a dentist. It's critical to your health, your physical health, your heart health. Your smile says so much about who you are. So make sure you make your appointment today by going to veneriadental.com or 856-786-2020. Coming back, it's the book everybody's talking about, Fight Inside the Wildest Battle for the White House. Don't go away.
The Rich Cioli Show on Talk Radio 1210 WPHT.
I'm really excited to welcome to the show Amy Parnes. Amy is a political reporter and the co-author of the book Fight Inside the Wildest Battle for the White House. It's available now, and it's the book everybody's talking about. Amy, thanks for joining us here in Philadelphia. How are you?
I'm good. How are you, Rich?
I'm doing well. I'm really enjoying the book, and I have a lot of questions for you. So good job on this. First question I got to ask right off the top of this is, I've always had this long belief that the debate that Joe Biden did was a complete setup to get him out of the race. I don't see any reason why they would have put him on that stage in June. I don't see any other reason why that would have happened. And as I'm reading your book, I'm starting to understand a little bit about why maybe they wanted it to happen, because they thought maybe it would somehow prove to everybody that he could do it. So help us understand that. Why would he ever take the debate stage in June when we don't have debates in June?
Because he was losing, and losing big, and his team wanted to, they strategized about a couple of things, how they could shake up the race. This was one thing they settled on, that they could have an early debate, and this would change the trajectory of the race. And it didn't go as planned. But, you know, even leading up to it, there were people like Nancy Pelosi who obviously didn't believe that he could do well, because she told him, you know, she framed it as, why would you want to, you know, belittle yourself and appear on stage with Donald Trump? But I think what she really meant in retrospect is, why would you do this? You could potentially embarrass yourself.
But they all knew how bad he was, right? I mean, that's what really is exposed in your book, is that they all knew how bad Biden was. And they were lying to us, and they were gaslighting us, and they were gaslighting people in the media like yourself and others. So, I mean, ultimately, isn't there somebody who pulls a kill switch here and says he's not getting on that stage and maybe tries to avoid debates?
No, I honestly didn't think that. I don't think that they thought it was going to go as badly as it did. I mean, they were pointing to, and we talked to a lot of people for this book, including people close to him. They were pointing to the State of the Union address and other big high profile moments to show that he does step up in these bigger moments. And they were hoping that he would that night. And it turns out he had a cold, but it was so much worse than that. And we take you inside. What this book does is, you know, a lot has been written and covered dealing with this time period. But what we try to do is put you in the room. So we take you, we open up this book and take you inside Nancy Pelosi's living room that night as she's watching the debate. Yeah. She's watching it alone. And Jim Clyburn, another Democratic leader in the House, is watching it alone. No one, you know, these are the types of events that where lawmakers gather. They have watch parties. Everyone decided to watch it alone that night. Barack Obama wasn't even watching it. And so we report all of this in great detail, and we kind of let you see what was happening and unravel it through the lens of all of these people who eventually push him out of the race.
Yeah, and you do a good job of that. I mean, you describe in great detail like how much ice cream was in Nancy Pelosi's freezer. So, you know, I mean, well done. And Al Sharpton having a cigar at his favorite cigar bar. So you do a nice job of painting the pictures of all that. And it's obvious the panic that comes through. But you know, I guess the question, all right, so first of all, Kamala Harris, obviously, they were plotting behind the scenes to replace Biden before he even withdrew from the race. So they wanted him gone. The Biden team did not want Harris in there, obviously. It turns out from your book that Obama didn't want Harris, and Pelosi didn't want Harris, and nobody wanted Harris. So the question then becomes, why didn't they do anything to replace Harris off the ticket?
They just couldn't. They were running out of time. I think Obama thought that there was still a little bit of time to maybe get something together and something going, which is why he kept calling people like Jim Clyburn, and we report this in the book. He calls him to take the temperature of where Clyburn and other leaders are, and Clyburn knows that he's about to call him, and he immediately gets behind Harris because he doesn't want to be in the position where he has to tell Obama that he's undecided and then Obama tries to convince him about an open primary. So he does that. But you can tell Obama has his fingerprints all over this. It hadn't been reported at the time, but he was clearly very convinced that Harris couldn't win. And it was why he was floating other alternatives and why he had some other people in mind to run against Donald Trump.
But they couldn't just find a way to do it at the convention, because, I mean, that's what I never really understood here. From a timing perspective, Biden is out in the summer. The convention's not till the end of August. They could have done it if they wanted to. I mean, they could have had an open primary at the convention. Whose decision ultimately would that have been? Would that have been Biden's as the president, or?
I mean, it would have been really messy is the thing. And let's not forget how messy it already was. They were looking for the best possible fix in that moment. She inherited a lot of his money. You know, he had the majority of the delegates. He could easily transfer them to her. For a lot of reasons, she just made the most sense. But, I know that a lot of Democrats were feeling very squeamish about her, the idea of her at the top of the ticket. In fact, Nancy Pelosi told someone, that she was talking to early on. She said, if he goes, she goes. She really felt that, if Biden was, getting out of the race, then Kamala Harris should get out of the race too. But it just wasn't practical with, you know, it was 100 plus days left of the race. They wanted to really get this going. They were down in the dumps. I mean, I have never spoken to Democrats around that time that were so depressed and dejected from the whole thing. They just wanted to move on quickly. And that, you know, someone told us at least she has a pulse, which is probably not the right framing you want for someone who's going to run against Donald Trump, but yeah, they were almost left with no options.
So Amy Parnes is with me. She and Jonathan Allen wrote the book Fight: Inside the Wildest Battle for the White House. You know, there's a lot of criticism of the media and saying that they didn't do a better job of reporting on Biden's cognitive decline. Some, not you, Amy, but some who really gaslit us and helped and said that Biden was, you know, the best version of Biden out there. I mean, is that fair criticism for the press corps that they didn't do a better job of highlighting just how bad Biden was?
I don't like that people loop everything in, you know, all of us in there, because I was not one of those people. Constantly asked about his age and his mental acuity. I wrote a lot of stories. If you look at my track record, you'll see that I was writing about this quite frequently and what an issue it was for him.
And that's why not you, Amy. Yeah.
But I take it personally because, you know, I really try to call balls and strikes as I see them. And that was definitely a strike against Biden. And we all knew it at the time.
Yeah, well, because, you know, had the Democrats, you know, had the truth come out sooner, they may have been able to replace him sooner and maybe had a fair and open process, possibly. So, you know, I mean, people who were gaslighting us, like Joe Scarborough and others, because there were people who were doing that. And you were not one of those people, but they were. They did themselves a disservice here because they didn't have time to replace her. But I guess, you know, looking back, though, as your book, you go into this, they may not have had the ability to replace her, even if Biden had gotten out months earlier, because they just didn't know what to do with Kamala Harris. I mean, that's what I got out of this. They just didn't know what to do. It was like they were stuck here and they just had to go with it and just hope for the best.
Yeah, and we report in great detail, too, about how the Biden people, for example, were telling donors, you don't want to be stuck with her. You know, that was something that they were openly telling people. You know, it was their last-ditch effort, clearly, but they really felt like he was in the best position to actually win. So they used these scare tactics almost, and people showed us these emails. I mean, this was like electronic record of, you know, top Biden officials sending these really nasty notes to donors, basically threatening them. Never been reported. The thing about this book that I think, and I'm not just saying this because this is my book, I think you learn something honestly on almost every page of this book, things that haven't been reported, and we get inside there to tell all the stories. I mean, I know we're focused a lot right now, you and I, on the Democratic side, but we tell a lot of stories about Trump and what a solid campaign he did run. A very tight ship run by Susie Wiles in a way that hadn't been run by President Trump before in past campaigns. So you really, this is a playbook, not, you know, I think we wrote this not just looking at the past and what happened, which a lot of people really want to know, but a playbook for both parties on, you know, what they did right and what they did wrong.
Fight: Inside the Wildest Battle for the White House. Yeah, look, I agree with you. I mean, his campaign was so disciplined in 2024 versus 2016 and 2020, without question. Now, how do you get access when you write a book like this? I mean, you're a political reporter and you know, you write for The Hill. But how do you get the kind of access to be able to get all this information? And particularly on the Democrat side, where people just dying to let everybody know the truth of what happened there. How do you guys get your sources and put all this together?
I mean, for starters, this is our third campaign book. We wrote Shattered in 2016 about the Hillary Clinton campaign that went wrong, went awry. We wrote Lucky in 2020. So we've been building sources, my co-author and I, for nearly a decade. So a lot of people know us, trust us. Mm-hmm. Of course, you know, we get hit a lot for... People think we sit on these stories. We don't sit on anything. In fact, I would get in trouble if I were sitting on anything with my bosses. My co-author and I did most of this reporting. I would say the bulk of the reporting came on the heels of the election. And so we get, and that's when people tell you the truth, to be honest. They're not going to tell you what's really going on before the election. You know, they'll have informal conversations with you about what they're thinking, but you don't really get the goods until after. And so we meet with as many people as possible, call as many people as possible. And we talked to more than 150 sources, Republicans, wow, Democrats, for this book. And these are people at the very highest levels of both campaigns.
You know, you've made a lot of news. I mean, the news about them putting makeup on Biden before Zoom calls and how he was basically asleep at Governor Murphy's house in New Jersey at that fundraiser. You've made a lot of news with this book. So congratulations on that. Do you get into the selection process for the vice president and the Veep stakes? Because I was amazed that she picked Tim Walz, to be honest with you. And I breathed a sigh of relief personally when she didn't pick Josh Shapiro, because I think it would have helped them. You know, that would have been a much better pick for them. Do you get into all that?
Yeah, we do on both sides. We get into really, really interesting stuff about how President Trump picked his running mate, Vance. You know, it came down to really fascinating stuff about how it came down to really two people, Rubio and Vance, and what Trump was thinking when he picked Vance. We get inside Trump Force One. There was a kind of battle going on between Lindsey Graham and Jason Miller, one of Trump's aides on Trump Force One, and you see them taking sides and pushing their own cases. You see the lobbying effort that actually happened and how it led to Vance's pick. And we do the same thing on the Democratic side, too, how she felt the most comfortable with Tim Walz and what a nervous wreck he was going into the first debate with Vance, how he couldn't eat, he couldn't sleep. I mean, we reveal all these details. It's a really interesting... you know, this is all stuff I didn't know when I was reporting for this book, and I found it fascinating. So I'm sure other people will, too.
Walz couldn't eat or sleep. He was that nervous. The guy's a governor.
He was so nervous. And this came from people who were working directly with him. He, you know, they had to encourage him and remind him to eat and sleep because he was so nervous. He thought he was going to mess up the whole thing for their ticket. This is stuff that, and we saw it all kind of playing out on stage, but now we kind of know more about that moment.
Yeah. Wow, Amy, that's really interesting. Thanks for making that news today. Is there a reason why she didn't go with Shapiro? Was it just the fact that she just didn't feel comfortable? I mean, you had to win Pennsylvania. Everybody said it was the must-win state. He was an extremely popular governor at the time. You know, I don't know how popular he is now, but at the time he certainly was. Did she just not like the guy? Did he not really want to do it? I mean, what was the deal?
I think she was a little bit suspicious of his own political aspirations, is how it's been explained to us. She always felt like she would have to kind of watch over him and what he was doing. And those were the same concerns, by the way, that President Biden had about her. And she had to prove that she was a loyal foot soldier. So she had those same sort of suspicions about him. And I think she just jived better with Walz. They had a better one-on-one interview. She felt a kind of kinship that she had with Biden, with him. And I feel like that's, she just felt more comfortable with him. And let's also remember what was going on politically with Israel at the time. I think that Democrats didn't want to, you know, pour salt on the wound. So I'm sure all of this played a big factor in her pick. But it wasn't just one thing. It was a collection of various things.
It wasn't just the fact that he was Jewish, but the fact that he was Jewish didn't help the case, in other words.
It didn't help. It didn't help.
Yeah. Amy Parnes is with me. The book is called Fight. It's the book everybody's talking about. The time that, like, going back, you know, to the 2020 election when Kamala Harris savaged Joe Biden on that debate stage and called him a racist and said, you know, I was that little girl, Joe, and, you know, accused him of being a segregationist and everything. And then he picks her to be his running mate, obviously, you know, which, I mean, happens in politics, right? That, you know, rivals come together. But did Joe Biden ever forgive her for that? Because it seems like in reading your book, there was a real hesitation to back her. Not only because they didn't think she could win, but I got a sense that there was some real personal animosity here that just really never went away.
I mean, I think it's safe to say some people have told us that Jill Biden, the former first lady, held a lot of things against Kamala Harris.
Dr. Jill Biden, you know, you have to say that by law. That's the law. You can, so, you know.
Yeah, but kidding, I think, no, she does like to go by doctor, that's for sure. But I do think that they, you know, the two principals had a decent relationship throughout their administration. But as we report in the book, he kind of warned her about going off script and going off message. And he said to her right before the debate with Trump, he said, "No daylight, kid," on a call ahead, just hours ahead of the debate. And that's why a lot of Democrats have asked me, why wouldn't she go in her own direction? And why wouldn't she kind of run more of her own campaign? And it's because he was sort of, you know, tightening the reins a bit and wanted to, you know, control the optics and his own legacy. And so that's why I think a lot of Democrats right now are kind of blaming him. They think that he's selfish and didn't allow her to be her own person. And a lot of her aides feel that way too, that he almost had, you know, that he almost choked her, not choked her physically, obviously, right, but wouldn't let her be her own person.
Is that why on The View when they asked her, what would you change? And she looked around and was like, I can't think of anything. I mean, that was one of the worst answers I've ever heard a candidate give in the history of politics. And talk about a gift to the Trump campaign.
I know. And the funny thing is that when she said it, her aides were all kind of shrugging because they had practiced what to say in case she did get that question. And it was a whole different answer than the one she gave. So they were sort of, they didn't know quite what had happened. But in retrospect, when you hear the president's warning to her about no daylight, it kind of makes sense.
Wow. Before I let you go, and again, congrats on writing this book, Fight, Inside the Wildest Battle for the White House. Tell me about the freaking Deadpool they had here, because that's amazing that they had this about a judge who would swear her in.
Yeah, they had, I mean, obviously, the job of the vice president's office is always to be prepared in case something does happen to the president. But this takes it to a whole new level. I mean, they were really preparing in case something happened. The DNC was preparing in the event that he might die in office. And one of her top aides carried around, whenever he traveled, he carried around a list of Republican judges because he always felt like things are so divisive in the country, and she almost needed some validation if she were to be sworn into office. And so he had an entire spreadsheet printed out every district with a Republican judge who could potentially swear her in should something happen to the former President Biden at the time.
I said last question, but one more question. How much of the assassination attempt on the on President Trump in Butler contributed to Biden's decision to get out of the race? Because it seems like after that, the momentum that Trump had, or the big mo, as they call it in politics, I mean, it seemed like surviving that and, you know, that moment. And I'm sure your book, you know, Fight, obviously, when he puts his hand up in the air and says fight, fight, fight. I mean, how much of that you think played a part in all this?
I mean, I know that in speaking to Joe Biden's staff at the time, and we spoke to quite a few people inside the campaign, they all felt in that moment that Trump had won the election.
Really?
And there was sort of a resignation. Like, you know, one staffer joked that his mom, he was at his mom's house, and this is a senior level staffer, this is in a junior, and his mom joked, or his mom wasn't joking, but she said, "Oh, I'm sorry, there goes the election." And, you know, this is how they viewed it in the moment. They just felt like, I mean, Joe Biden was already down in the dumps. They were dealing with, you know, the fallout from the debate. He hadn't dropped out yet. So think about that. And then the assassination attempt happens and they're trying to figure out, they're trying to get their bearings and they can't, you know, that this is a moment. It's a powerful, powerful image, of the president with his fist in the air. And, you know, he conveyed it was a moment, like him or hate him. I mean, even Democrats admitted that was an image of strength. And that's why they were feeling so glum about their chances in the moment.
You can see why, no doubt about it. Fight inside the wildest battle for the White House, Jonathan Allen and Amy Parnes. Amy, thanks so much for joining me here today. I really enjoyed this conversation and congrats on the book. Best of luck.
Thanks. And let me know when you finish reading it. I'm curious to hear what you think.
I absolutely will. And so far I'm loving it. So great job.
Thank you so much.
The Rich Cioli Show on Talk Radio 1210 WPHT.
All right, as we continue along the show here today, 855-839-1210 on X at Rich Cioli if you want to weigh in. The Attorney General of New Jersey, the United States Attorney for New Jersey, Alina Haba, going after gangs. There's some news on that that I want to share with you as well. And she said that juveniles who commit murder will be tried as adults. That was conveyed today as well. And of course, there's a big question going on regarding women, sports, athletics, and this, I think, very brave woman fencer at the University of Maryland, this competition, who took a knee and said she would not compete because her opponent was a biological male. So we'll talk about that as well as the show goes on today. And Paula Scanlon will join us a little bit later. We'll get her take on everything that happened. She's been a leader, obviously, in that whole entire fight for women to be able to compete without having bio dudes compete against them. So we'll talk about that as well. Now, listen, Dr. Mike Veneria has been my family dentist for years. And for over 10 years, 10 consecutive years, he's been known and recognized among his peers as a master of dental implants, a master of giving you the smile of your dreams. And that's why other doctors refer their patients to Dr. Mike Veneria. He's available for emergency dental repair, root canals, you name it. But the area where he shines above all else is those very complicated dental implants. And you can get a free implant consultation with Dr. Mike. All you got to do is go to VeneriaDental.com, V-A-N-A-R-I-A, VeneriaDental.com, with two locations to serve you in Cinnaminson and Woodbury. You should make Dr. Mike your guy, and you should make your appointment today because you'll see that he takes great care of his people. There's great people in the office. There's great music playing in the office. So what are you waiting for? It's good to see a dentist. You know, it's good for your health, your overall health, your microbiome, your gut. There's a link between your mouth health and your gut microbiome and your heart health and all of it. So don't wait. Go see him today. Dr. Mike Veneria, VeneriaDental.com.
The Rich Cioli Show on Talk Radio 1210 WPHT.
I know you and I are texting, but we might as well have this conversation on the air. I think I did not hear anyone else write about the fact that after the attempted assassination that the Biden campaign knew it was over for them.
No, that is interesting. There was a bunch of stuff that I thought was really interesting in that interview. The Waltz being too nervous to eat is pretty funny. And then I thought the biggest revelation was Kamala Harris's aides having judges ready to swear her in the event Biden died or resigned. That is genuinely shocking.
Absolutely. That I'd heard before, but I did not hear the stuff about Butler. I haven't seen that printed anywhere, so maybe we can make some news on that.
We'll post a couple things from that interview. She was great.
Yeah, no, she was. She was really great. I appreciated her time. It was good. I'm a nerd, so I love all that insider baseball stuff. But they're good writers too. It's, you know, this stuff can get heady, but they do a good job of keeping it at base level. So. It's good. No, and I don't agree though with the analysis of they thought that debate would turn the corner. I think that's BS. I think that debate was entirely done to sabotage him to get him out of the race. So I respectfully disagree with their conclusion on that.
Well, wasn't there a piece, I believe, it was published yesterday about your dear friend Ron Klain saying that things weren't going well for Biden during debate prep.
Yeah, that jackass. That guy who took a screenshot
no way
of me.
To talk about your buddy.
Yeah, as White House Chief of Staff, took a screenshot of me on Fox and tweeted it out with the caption, "People on Fox don't look happy about the economic news," or something stupid like that. That loser. That moron. So, yeah, he now, after gaslighting us, comes out and says that Biden looked terrible during debate prep and he didn't think he could get through the debate. So, and he was Chief of Staff, right? So that's your kill switch right there. That's the kill switch. That's my point. That proves my point, because you should get the authors of that book on too, actually, because that's a different book that's coming out.
Yeah, you know? I can reach out to them. They'd be great.
But the Ron Klain thing proves my thesis, which is that Obama, the whole debate was a setup, because he's the White House Chief of Staff. He's the top guy. He's got the kill switch. He says the president's not going on that stage. The president's not going on that stage. There's no one that outranks him, not even the campaign manager. No one. So that's it. You know, his word is final. And the president had a cold and he would have just said to him, you know, the debate's been canceled. He would have just lied to Biden and he would have protected him. He would have done whatever he had to do to protect him. If it wasn't for the fact that that was done to show everybody how bad he was to get him out of the race. So, yeah, the fact that the White House Chief of Staff was commenting during debate prep at Camp David on how bad the president was, you don't let him take the stage unless you want him to take the stage to get him out of the race to replace him as the candidate. And that's what happened. So I think my thesis on that is confirmed and spot on, if you ask me. So coming up, Kosovo announcing they're dropping all tariffs against the United States of America. You could call that winning. And we will, as we enter our 5 o'clock happy hour, brought to you by our friends at the Grand Hotel of Cape May, New Jersey. Don't go away.
The Rich Cioli Show on Talk Radio 1210 WPHT.